Welcome to the Business of Security podcast, episode number 23. Your host is Chad Beckman, founder of TrustMap. Today, he talks with Malcolm Harkins, Chief Security and Trust Officer with Cymatic. Now, let's get to it.
What does the industry need to start talking about that we're not doing today?
Information technology is built on a horrible foundation. If we could sort of redo and start from the beginning, we would be so much better off.
If you don't invest in it, keep it running, it will blow up.
But you also have to be able to go in with solutions, not just problems. We have a long way to go if we're going to win this fight.
At the end of the day, educated people are really the best countermeasure against all the threats,
Welcome to the Business of Security podcast. This is your host, Chad Beckman, and I'm very excited about our special guest today joining us, Malcolm Harkins. Malcolm, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chad. Happy to be here.
So, Malcolm, for our viewers that may not know about you and, you know, specifically your background, if you could share with us just, you know, a couple of minutes on your experience in the industry and you know, honestly, why some call you, I guess, a luminary.
Yeah, they might call me that. They might call me other things, too, depending upon what comes out of my mouth at times. So I'm a bit of an oddball relative to most of the peers that I have in the industry. Currently, I'm Chief Security and Trust Officer of a security startup called Cymatic that focuses on web application, web services security. Previous to that, I was for 4 years the Chief Security and Trust Officer for Cylance Corporation that was recently bought earlier this year by BlackBerry. And prior to that, I worked for Intel for almost 24 years, and I was Worldwide Chief Security and Privacy Officer. Now, that doesn't sound too odd other than the fact that I'm not a technologist. I've got an undergraduate in economics, an MBA in finance and accounting. And the first 10, 11 years of my roles at Intel prior to tripping my way into security was in business and finance, procurement, business operations, strategic planning.
I think, and I think maybe perhaps that last key word is probably one of the most significant, particularly today, as security, information security, cybersecurity has really matured over the last couple of decades. And that is becoming a bit more strategic. We often hear the term aligning to the business. And one of the topics we want to cover today is talking about that. How do we align everything we're doing from a security perspective really to the business in a strategic manner, specifically around assessments? On that topic of assessment fatigue, how do we begin to, you know, look at this challenge slightly differently? Because it seems as an industry, security kind of started off through audit and as a means of achieving compliance and meeting certain, you know, minimum controls. And now we are continuing to see new regulations come out, but we at the same time must support the business and show how security is enabling business, particularly in this modern age of every business is online, data is exchanged digitally, it's no longer exchanged hardly in any other form for that matter. So how does an organization, how does a security team begin that process from your perspective, coming at it from the background that you have?
Well, I think you first have to figure out what your mission is. And I think many information security organizations still today have a mission that's something along the lines of what I had the first 4 or 5-ish years I was running security at Intel, safeguard information assets, blah, 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 whatever the rest of the statement was. And for me, circa 2008, maybe 2009, when I was getting ready to present to Intel's board of directors, and it was the first time we were doing an information risk review with the board, I had 30 minutes to convey all aspects of information risk to them. And so when you have that shortened time window, you start to try and get really pithy on key sets of data and information and stuff to distill to them. But I wanted to give them some concept of the organization and our purpose. And as I was going through that process of trying to be pithy and not have a 5 pages explaining the organizational structure, what we do, where we focus and stuff, I just tried to start truncating down. And that caused me to step back and think about, why do we exist? What is our purpose? And I had always thought of the business outcomes that I needed to deliver for Intel and its shareholders back even when Andy Grove was running Intel and I started running IT security and business continuity after 9/11 and Code Red and NIMDA. And those business outcomes were always, how do I create a demonstrable and sustainable bend in the curve of risk? How do I manage total cost of controls? Former finance guy, cash is king, can't continue to throw money at the problem. And then how do I manage this notion of what I call control friction? You know, because controls are a drag coefficient. They slow down people, data, and the business. They chew up unnecessary compute cycles. And that control friction also costs the business and generates other risk issues. And so as I was thinking back to those early days of those business outcomes I was trying to deliver and what our purpose was, why did we exist? I had an epiphany. It was simple. And I changed the mission completely that day and then continued to focus on it. It's the subtitle of my books, Protect to Enable. If we're not protecting to enable the people, the data, and the business, we're getting in the way, we're wasting time, we're wasting money. If it's protection for protection's sake, nobody really wants to do that. So, some security teams might, but if it's not really protecting to enable the corporate mission, enable the internal customers, the external customers, enable that business objective, you're not aligned. And so that awakening I had to that and the shift I made after that made it much easier to be aligned with the business. Now, a lot of folks confuse being aligned with the business and not holding the business accountable either. So the security team needs to be aligned to the business, but the business also needs to align to security in the day and age that we're in. And given the digitization that businesses have done and the societal implications of that. So it has to be both ways versus just security, what I'd say, bending towards the business, because I've seen too many people do that. And then they become the yes man or yes woman to the business and everything now becomes a yes versus a how, or in some cases, a no, this isn't happening on my watch. And the security team and the privacy team still needs to hold the business accountable and protecting to enable doesn't mean you let go of that.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because I often run into it, and I've recently had a conversation with a CIO that said, look, our team is very focused on compliance and telling the business no. In this case, the team said no to a marketing initiative that another portion of the business was undertaking. And in the course of about 45 days, they saw over $1.5 million in revenue decline off of their books. And they traced the problem back to, the normal marketing process wasn't being done. As a result, the sales started to fall off. And tracing that back to why that happened, it was security that said no. And so how does security become not the office of no, but the office of enable, but doing so in a safe manner? So from your perspective, and I love that term, that phrase, protect to enable, how do we get the business to support security in that context? Because it's easy for us to say, security must support the business. We've heard, I think, a lot of talk about that. How do we look at it on the opposite direction?
Well, I think this gets back into decision-making, the aspects of risks, and the details of some of those things. I've certainly held up marketing campaigns and launches. I've held up product launches. There are revenue implications of that and time to market implications. At the same time, I've done it in most cases with the business or with a level of escalation. So that way, the CEO You know, because in some cases, you know, and I had this dialogue a number of times, even back when I was at Intel, and the CIO would come to me and say, you know, I would be turning right and they would want to go left. And they'd say, you know, Malcolm, you work for me. So I'm telling you to go left instead of right. And I'd go, no, you don't understand. I don't work for you because you don't write my paycheck. I work for a company called Intel that's owned by shareholders. And this decision is above your pay grade. You have a $2 million signature authority, and this is a $100 million risk impact to the company. It's above your pay grade. And so we'll either go down my path or we can walk up to somebody who can sign for $100 million worth of risk. So sometimes you have to do that. And sometimes when you take it up a level or two, yeah, the business will say, that's too risky. You know, other times they'll say, we can accept that risk. And then the question still becomes risk to who? Because if it's risk to the business, you know, a CEO, a business unit manager at the right level can make that decision because it's a business risk that'll impact shareholders and they're paid to do that. But if that risk then starts affecting consumers or society, you know, again, it's a different context of who's impacted by the risk. You know, it's like when Maersk, the shipping container company, you know, a couple of years ago with the ransomware, you know, and I can't remember the exact numbers, but, you know, when they had that ransomware impact, it was, what, $100 million, couple hundred million dollars impact to their P&L. They have may have made a conscious decision to accept the cyber risk and had even they might have even calculated out to $100+ million and said, yep, that's acceptable risk. But when you think about it more broadly, the macroeconomic impact of that, the slowing down of the shipment of goods was probably $10 billion. And if there was medical equipment or medicine on some of those shipping containers that was necessary to save somebody's life, somebody could have died on the other side of it if it didn't get there on time. You know, so when you start rippling out what the real risk issues are, we've got to contemplate and get the business to think beyond just the typical bottom line to the company, particularly if there's broader customer societal implications to it. And, you know, and so depending upon the context of the risk issue where the security team said no, that may have been an appropriate decision. And if the CIO or others didn't like it at the time, the question was it an informed decision? Did the right people make it?
It's a very complicated decision process that you outlined. And
it is.
You know, how many companies, it's a rhetorical question perhaps, but how many companies truly take it as far out as the different scenarios that, you know, as far as, you know, the Maersk example, people impacted, their healthcare perhaps being impacted because they are not getting the goods or the medicines or whatever that might be that they need in a timely fashion, right? And
I think so. Yeah, some do, unfortunately not enough. And, you know, and so I always ask myself and I've asked my teams and I ask my peers, are you contemplating risk or just calculating it? You know, and I've always seen my job, part of it is to pose the high contrast questions to ensure the right debate and discussion occurs. And I've characterized my role as one of being a choice architect. How am I architecting choices for the business? And yeah, you know, some of those choices I get to make the decision on. Some of them I don't. But if you start thinking about it that way, you start changing your dynamics. Just like when I was in finance. Finance could say no to a purchase order because it's required to co-sign a purchase order above a certain dollar amount. Does that mean that finance, if that purchase order didn't get done and the equipment didn't get installed in the factory and all of a sudden there was greater demand than people thought and revenue was somehow not optimized, finance is accountable? You could look at it that way, or you could look at it and say there was a crappy business justification and finance made the right decision to say, no, we're not buying that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's circle back to, you know, sort of this assessment fatigue issue, and compliance is typically the driver of a lot of that, right? Continuous monitoring we're hearing lately, and let's do an assessment every week or every month. And, you know, now we have the CCPA, of course, looming deadlines, and GDPR is out there, of course, and any other next new regulation that might come about. How does the company get ahead of that instead of always becoming reactive, right? And feeding this risk dialogue. And I love the term you used, and the choice architect, right? Architecting better decisions, essentially. How does a team begin to sort of get out of the mire of the day-to-day, very tactical, let's check the box. Yep. Okay. We hit that control. We're done until the next fire drill or until the next quarter when we have to re-up our status. How does a team get beyond what I consider that to be more reactive, right? And getting out of this assessment cycle to becoming a bit more strategic and a bit more proactive in nature, while of course still achieving the checkbox requirements that various regulatory bodies need.
Yeah, I'm a little bit jaded on this. I mean, we see it on the assessment fatigue, but we've also seen it with the alert fatigue, right? And this whole, let's just detect and react constantly, right? Rather than get in front of it. So I think we see it both on the day-to-day security model, which is highly reactive, as well as we see it on the compliance model. It, you know, and I've looked at my view of this is, you know, compliance and commitment are two different things. And for me, I've always tried to frame it as compliance is the residue of good security and privacy. If you're doing good practices, you will therefore have a level of compliance. And there might be some minor things that you need to play with or tweak or do. But it becomes a how do you, if you look at SOC 2, FedRAMP for the U.S. government, payment card industry standard compliance, HIPAA, high tech, you've got, you know, and there's a boatload of other ones, right? How do I design my control environment for what I should be doing, which is having good security and privacy? And then how do I look at those compliance regimes and basically thread them together so I can test once and assure to many compliance regimes? It's an architectural issue. It's not perfect, and you're going to have some things that are a little bit disjointed. But I've always tried to do it in a way that I can have a few key controls that hit all the compliance regimes. Well, if I can do that, I can test once and reuse it many times, right? Now, there is an aspect of continuous monitoring and continuous auditing that is also to some extent appropriate, right? Because people are making changes constantly. They're updating code, they're, you know, modifying this, modifying that. So there is a level of continuous monitoring that we should be doing. But a lot of that, if you've done it right, hopefully comes from the metrics and measurements that we've instrumented. And then you just attest to the system that's pulling that stuff on a routine basis. And then your continuous audit or continuous monitoring comes from, you know, the data that you're getting and validating the integrity of that data flow on a periodic basis. And so therefore, you've reduced the burden. You know, what we've got to do is get yield off of our investments. And we've got to automate more of this stuff so that it's less of a burden. And if you get an audit from left field, you go, have at it, run a report. Here's your data, right? And keep moving. You know, because again, what we've got to do is provide automation for the metrics and measurement, automation for controls validation and simulated attack simulation and pen testing to a variety of other things. Cause that will make it less annoying and less burdensome. And if we do that right, we'll be able to constantly demonstrate compliance, but we're demonstrating compliance because we're practicing good security and privacy at the end of the day.
I think you just hit the nail on the head. If we circle back to the conversation about getting the business to buy into security, you know, you said a word that I sort of want to highlight here, and that is get yield, right? Get yield out of our efforts, out of our controls, and so on. And so how do we get yield? How do we get more value out of these exercises, out of this activity? And I think if we can articulate the story, which I believe you just laid out the entire recipe for people to follow and achieve, at least at a high level, is if we can show that message to the business as to why perhaps in many cases security programs need to take one step back to go three or five steps forward, right? Hit pause for a moment to recollect and understand exactly what is being thrown at the business and organize to become a bit more proactive in managing good security hygiene for the organization instead of becoming more reactive and just responding to compliance requests and audit requests, as you indicated, right? Those are still requirements. Those are still activities that will happen, but it'll be more as a deliverable out of a well-managed, well, as you said, architected program. I think that's perhaps a way that I see teams that they can begin to get the business to buy in by saying, look, we want to serve the needs of this organization as it extends into various new industries, perhaps, or countries where there are new and different regulations. But in order to do that, we need to clearly understand and be in the conversation as these decisions happen so we can architect our program to support it seamlessly. Instead of being told at the 11th hour and so forth, and as a result, we'll need less consultants perhaps, or there'll be a much higher SLA back to the business, right? And in terms of some of these choices that need to be made around risk, am I capturing that? What you're alluding to here?
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think it's an architectural issue. It's a decision making issue, and it doesn't mean that you're going to get out of a compliance requirement that honestly is just a stupid dumbass control, in which case you'll have to do a compensating control analysis. You might have to do it anyways, because you might have an external auditor that is a check the box person. And if you don't check that box, you're going to fail. And I've been in those situations. I was in that situation not that long ago with a FedRAMP type item. And it just made no sense. And we had to do it anyways, but I'm like, look, I'm not going to spend any money on it. Let's go get some open source capability, put the stuff in there, let the light blink, check the box and keep moving, because it's an irrelevant control and I don't want to waste time on it. And that's what we ended up doing. And I hated doing that, but at the same time, an external auditor wasn't going to budge. And it was like, okay, well, then I'm going to get through it with as least amount of pain and money spent as possible.
Well said. As an organization begins to, I think, ultimately remove control duplication, right? That's a bit of what we're talking about here. Reduce the number of controls that we're continuing to measure that have a lot of overlap or asking for the same things. And how do we go about making this a more repeatable process? Once we feel as if maybe we've got an inventory of everything that the business has to manage from both security and privacy. How does this turn into something that becomes very repeatable? What does that look like? If you could sort of paint the picture for our listeners.
Well, on the one hand, everything we said should get you into more repeatability, but the practicality of it is once you're in that repeatability, you're going to have to be constantly changing. Technology's changing. Usage models are changing. The business is evolving. So we can't also leave controls that are static. You look at, traditional intrusion detection systems, traditional antivirus, heck, even username or passwords. They've all failed us, yet they're baked into compliance regimes, right? Mm-hmm. Why? Because people wanted to routinize the work and say, I just need username or password and it needs to be complex and it needs to change every 90 days, right? Or now it's everybody needs to go deploy multi-factor authentication. And yeah, multi-factor authentication is a good step up type thing, but I'm also pinging another untrusted device with a user that I don't know who's on the other side, with a phone number that's in a system that could be manipulated. So you're building assurance based upon some level of possible trust, right? So we've got to really, again, think through these three dimensions of risk, cost, and the control friction, and focus on controls that count, right? And then have an appropriate level of redundancy for controls, knowing that you can't eliminate risk. So, you know, there's this notion that I've got a set of irrefutable laws of information security that I wrote years ago. And one of them is that controls deteriorate over time, right? It's like building a dam. You know, eventually the forces of water and the sediment build up. You know, it's controlling water, but it only has a useful life of so long, right? Without maintenance and stuff like that. And so we've got to think about that and recognize that that's true in our security controls as well, is that there's a deterioration rate that occurs with some of them, and in different life cycles. And unless we are recognizing that deterioration rate and then also staying on top of it, we're going to think we're controlling for risk when we're not. And that's also part of the problem with the compliance regimes, because they're fairly static.
Mm-hmm. They are. How many organizations have been PCI compliant and they faced a credit card breach, as an example?
Exactly. All of them.
Right. Exactly. So just to pick on compliance for a moment. Anything you want to leave our listeners before we conclude our session?
Yeah, you know, it's when we think about it, this is hard work, right? But hard work beats talent that doesn't work so hard. So you might be really smart, but unless you're doing the hard work and recognizing this is not easy and it's a journey with no finish line, and we've got to continue to always evolve, we've always got to continue to invest. We've always got to continue to stay strategic. And if we're doing that and thinking about the temporal aspects of risk and the decisions we make today, it's going to affect our risk and control environment a day from now, a week from now, 10 years from now. You know, and again, I see this in the business, and that's one thing. Business folks see that, right? They see the money I invest in a factory. If I don't do that, I won't be able to produce. If I don't invest in marketing and advertising, I won't get the customer awareness. You know, so they're constantly thinking about all these dynamic issues and its effect on the business and out in various windows of time. And as the information security teams and the compliance teams, we've got to get better at that strategic thinking. And I think if we can do that, it becomes less onerous, doesn't reduce the hard work, but hopefully puts us in a better mindset on how to tackle it.
Well said. Very well said. Well, thank you, Malcolm. I appreciate you taking time and sharing your insights today with our listeners. And if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do so?
They can reach out to me on LinkedIn, Malcolm Harkins at LinkedIn, or you can get me on Twitter at Protect2Enable. Or you can drop me an email at malcolm.harkins@cymatic.io.
Thanks again, sir. And appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks for listening to the Business of Security podcast. We want to hear from our listeners. If you have a topic that you'd like to discuss in the podcast or would like to continue the conversation, please connect with us on Twitter at CyberSecPodcast. Or email us at businessofsecurity@trustsds.com. A special thanks to today's guest, Malcolm Harkins. Our host today was Chad Beckman, founder of TrustMap. You can connect with Chad on LinkedIn and learn more about TrustMap at trustmap.com. Our show was produced by Dan Rollins with LiveWire Films. You can connect with Dan on LinkedIn and learn more about LiveWire at livewirefilms.com. Be sure to check out our next episode with Jason Lisch, Chief Information Security and Data Officer for Advisor Group. You've been listening to the Business of Security podcast, and that's a wrap.